We left off and we were talking about some of the challenges David had. He had a famine, and for 3 years he assumed it was a famine like all other famines, meaning that most of the time we deal with regular natural occurrences. It's a bad crop, it's a good crop, the car works, the car doesn't work. And then every now and then we see the hand of Hashem in something where it's not just the usual everyday occurrences. Every red light we get, we can't say, Hashem, why'd you give me a red light? But then there are other times where something happens where you clearly see the hand of Hashem in what happens. That, like, Hashem is directing the show. And so he became convinced that this was a message from Hashem, that there was a national problem. And they discovered the issue with the Givonim. And we mentioned that this was a huge sign to people that in the Jewish people there are no different levels. You have kings and princes and poor people, because over here the greatest people, the princes of the house of Sheol, were punished because of the Givonim that were not taking care of the water carriers. The water carriers was never was like the manual labor. You have to worry about them. They're people too. And so, and then we also talked about how strange that at the same time that the house of Sheol was punished for the bad that, the wrong that they did needed to be fixed. On the other hand, they had to be mourned properly, and that there really wasn't time to mourn them earlier, and at this time they were mourned. Does anybody remember which verse we left off with?
It was verse 10.
Verse 10? Okay. So apparently there was an understanding that there would have to be a certain amount of descendants that would be killed, mm-hmm. and they had one extra. So the question was which one. This whole thing was not a decision that we could make, a court could make. We wouldn't be able to decide who deserved death, who didn't. But they had. They had the Urim V'Tumim, they had the breastplate of Hashem, and they had the divine presence, and they were able to ask Hashem exactly which one. And so apparently initially Ish-Boshes, who was the descendant of Yonasan, it indicated that he was going to be killed, that he deserved to die. And David at this point used his most powerful weapon, his prayer, and he said, how could I face Yonasan if I let it? And he prayed again, let's try it again, and this time Ish-Boshes passed, he was excused, and it was another descendant that was taken.
Because in verse 8, it says his name as one of the seven.
Yeah.
That's another Ish-Boshes, he said.
Yeah, they have similar names. It's because it says in verse 7, it says the king took pity on Mephibosheth.
Yeah. Isn't he the crippled one?
Yeah, he's the one that was crippled when they, that's right.
His name was repeated in verse 8, so I can't figure out.
So, that was the, there's two. There's Mephibosheth, and then there's, let's see. Well, it was Mephibosheth. Okay.
Yeah, the same thing, I'm sorry. But he's counted among the seven.
Well, first it says he spared him, and then it says he took the Isaiah. Is that one? Are two different people? I think that maybe he brought him there, but I think he spared him. Because it indicates he spared him, so how could it be that he hung him up?
Last week you said they were just two different people.
Two different ones? Ish-Boshes and Mephibosheth are different, but here it says, in verse 7, it says he took pity on Mephibosheth, mm-hmm. and then in verse 8 it says he handed him over.
Right.
So, Maybe they were cousins. I'll look into that. We'll see what we can find out. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, verse 10, and then we mentioned that the mother of some of the princes then looked after the other princes and kept the birds away with a special sign of devotion, like an honorable mention that must have been a very difficult job to, you know, it must have been very sad. And Vatika, verse 10, she covered them, and it was a long time. It was from the beginning of one season until the rainy season. Now, to scare away the birds like to go to corpses and things. And so this was a very difficult job, but there was a lot of respect and honor for the her descendants and her children and the other children. And the only reason it's mentioned here is, verse 11, it's interesting. You might have thought that maybe they deserve to be punished, that they shouldn't be covered. But verse 11, "Viyugad leDavid," it was told to David, it was told that what she had done, Pelegishol, that it was a good thing that she respected their memory, respect, even though they perhaps as a government they should have been more careful for the lower classes, the wood carriers and the wood choppers and the water carriers, but she cared that they shouldn't be to try to respect their final resting place. Verse 12, and David went and he took the bones of Shaul v'esasmos Yonasan b'no and the bones of Yonasan m'eis bala yavish gila. They had been buried in a hurry, if you remember. The Plishtim had nailed them up against the wall in the house of the idols, which I mentioned to you that they actually discovered that temple, the remains of that temple in the archaeology that's listed. And they had gone in the middle of the night and taken those bones and removed them from there and very quickly buried them, kind of like in a secret burial. They didn't set up a big monument because they didn't want the Plishtim coming back and starting up. But they weren't buried properly in a dignified manner for a king. This was all done in the middle of the night in order to avoid the Plishtim. So David went, and typically we don't rebury people unless it's for their honor. In other words, if they weren't buried in a place of honor and there are certain questions that need to be asked or need to be discussed with authorities, but from time to time, especially today, we see this happening where people would be buried on the side of the road in Europe, and they want to remove the remains and bring them to Israel because there's no family members there, and the Europeans are slowly turning the cemeteries into parks and things, and so there are many famous rabbis and sages that have been removed, they've taken the remains to Israel. There is a discussion about it. I knew of a fellow who's after the war, the main cemetery in Vilna was relocated. The war destroyed all the cities, and so they were rebuilding, and there were no Jews left, and so in many areas they just took over, they started building in the middle of the Jewish cemeteries. And so they were given the opportunity to remove some of the graves of the Vilna Gaon and of the other people who were in the cemetery in Vilna. And this fellow's uncle was one of the few Jews who were alive who took part in the... two things that they saw that happened, that he heard this directly from his mother's brother, that when they removed the Vilna Gaon's grave, he was whole, which was very unusual for someone that had passed away, you know, 200 years ago or whatever. We have a tradition that the righteous don't rot. You know, that their bones don't, and they just couldn't get over it. You know, they dug in that spot, and it had been, you know, 150 years, 200 years, and it was whole. And the interesting thing was, the other grave that they removed was, there was a famous convert, Count Patak, there was a Polish count that had converted to Judaism and then been burned at the stake. They didn't like it when you converted to Judaism, and they had saved part of his body that had not been destroyed by the fire and buried him next to the Vilna Gaon, and that was also removed. The only other thing was that all of the people that were involved in the reburial died within the year. That was the... some people felt that... I don't know what to do with that. I mean, some people felt that they shouldn't have removed the bodies, or they should have had faith that it wouldn't happen, or the... But it was a spooky story. A lot of things we don't know what to do with. But anyway, just the removal of bones is not a simple issue. I just want to mention it. At least from our perspective, we say, you know, person's final rest. But there is what to talk about if the person wasn't buried in a respectful manner, or there's a more respectful way to do it. Then there is some discussion about it. There's also the option sometimes where they bury somebody temporarily, and because the place where they would eventually be buried isn't ready, and so then they kind of make a condition like that they'll only be there for a short amount of time, and then they'll relocate it. You mention it because you never know when you'll get to the subject again. In other words, sometimes you learn Tanakh or you have a subject, and you'll never go to a class on. Is it the Jews allow somebody to be reburied? You'll never attend a class like that, and so the Talmud is like that. They scatter different laws in the funniest, you know, in unusual places, and you just learn them at the time, and then when it comes up, you'll say, yeah, I remember learning if it's for the person's respect or honor that, you know, it can sometimes be done, and so that's, we would learn that from here. Well, Israel has a different challenge, which is that it's a very ancient country. And so whenever they build, they always find, what happens is that we're supposed to respect people's final, in other words, the ideal situation is if they're digging and they find graves, they should leave them undisturbed. And so the religious people, they take this strict sense of the law, they feel that if they find, you know, these are our great, you know, these might be our grandparents there, we're not going to, and so therefore they want the builders not to disturb the graves. Whereas the builders, the last thing they want to do is find a grave there, because that means it's going to stop the whole operation for years. Because then they have to get antiquities involved and find out, and it's lawsuits. And so they if they find graves, they don't tell anybody, and they sneak them out, because this way they can continue building. And so then the religious people kind of spy on the builders to see. So every now and then they have riots about these graves, and nobody knows where the real truth lies. They found graves, and they found some experts that said that they weren't Jewish graves, they were pagans. So if it's pagans, you know, maybe it's not so bad to, but it, you know, at some point, how do you know, and who's the expert? And anyway, so they removed the grave of Shaul that was. It's in verse 12. It almost says like they were like stolen. They was just like buried in a hurry. The He took the bones of Shaul at Sassiyon's Beno. Again, we find this in the Torah where they took the bones of Yosef. Moshe Rabbeinu took the bones of Yosef. There's an idea that you have to build on the greatness of previous generations. You have to recognize what the previous generations did. And David, who was coming after Shaul, certainly would want to recognize the accomplishments of Shaul. That's the taking care of the bones. They were taken from Rochel Beishan, the Shatulim, that were hung there by the Plishtim, Beyom Hakos Plishtim as Shaul beGilboa. That's the day that they had killed Shaul in Gilboa. Yosef was afraid that the people were very comfortable in Egypt, and they felt maybe that they belonged there. And so he, even though it would have been uncomfortable because it would have showed disloyalty to his country, he made a point of showing that he felt, even though he reached very high station in Egypt, he wanted to be buried in the land of Israel. And that was the 13. They gather them together. Verse 14. Now, there's very interesting rules, by the way. When they do have these reburials, there's a new funeral, and the people have to mourn again. There's a reburial, there's like a new. It's not Shiva, I think they just do it that day, but there's interesting rules that happen when somebody is reburied. So here he was brought to, this term is often used like a person that is buried in the grave of their forefathers, their family plot. So he was buried in the plot of Kish's father. And they did, people did what they were told. And then almost immediately the famine stopped. There was rest. And so they understood that this particular, these issues that had prevented them, which was one was to properly eulogize and recognize the accomplishments of Scholl, and the other was to fix the mistake of Scholl with the woodchoppers and the water carriers. And we mentioned that there was a huge wave of converts after that because many peoples, the ancient peoples, they wouldn't, they like to be a Roman. You had to be, they didn't accept servants or serfs, or that was not a, whereas in the Jewish people, we accept, you know, if a person is a good person, there's no, it's not a class, our society doesn't have a class. You're not born a nobleman, or if a person is worthwhile, no matter, you know, what station, if their father's a water carrier or a woodchopper, it doesn't matter. One other thing that happened that's mentioned in the Gemara was that after this, the people decided that they would not accept converts from the Gibbonim. They wouldn't allow the Gibbonim to marry into the regular Jewish people. The Gibbonim was this, they were very clannish in general, the Jewish people. We had the clans of each tribe. And the Gibbonim were this separate people who were the lowly workers, the woodchoppers and the water carriers. And they had adopted Judaism. They had lived amongst the Jews. And actually, I remember we were talking about whether they were full Jews or not Jews. But they decreed that they wouldn't allow a regular Jew to marry into the Gibbonim. Because the Gibbonim here were very poor and were starving. And they offered, the first offer that David had made to them was, all right, we'll give you all jobs. We'll relocate you. We'll give you farms. We'll give you. We'll set you up now to fix it. And they insisted that they didn't want that. They wanted revenge. They wanted to kill. And David pleaded with them, you know, and they wouldn't. They wouldn't give in. And they said, "This is not the Jewish way. Jews are forgiving. The people were forgiving. It's not a. It's not. There's something that he felt that they showed a certain stubbornness. And this, especially after somebody had died." You know, to take his descendants and hang them up. He had tried to prevent this, but the Gibbonim had that. To them, it was more important to take revenge than it was to meet their needs, to have food and clothing for their children. Sometimes you wonder if you see that in the Arabs. You know, they're more interested in fighting the Jews than they are than solving their own problems and taking care of themselves. 15. And there was another war with the Plishtim. There's always wars with the Plishtim, right? That's Yisrael. And David went with his servants with him. Now, this is one of the reasons that we feel this also that it's out of order. If you remember, when they fought Avshalom, David and his men, Yoav had made a deal with him, and he said, you shouldn't go out into battle with us anymore. That it, David in his younger years was a leader. You remember, he killed 1,000 Plishtim single-handedly. But in later years, they convinced him to stay home, and they would fight because he was too valuable that they had to lose the king. But this perhaps was at the earlier stages, as we mentioned, that it's really they wanted to list earlier what had happened with Bathsheba, the beginning and the end, and put it all together. And some of these events that we're reading about now actually occurred earlier in the book. So during the earlier times, there was this battle with the Plishtim and David and Sarah, and the Yuchemes Plishtim, the Yoav David. And David became weak, which was unusual. In other words, David, the great warrior, there was a certain battle that he experienced a weakness. And at that moment, he was in mortal danger. The Yishbi Benov, and there was a famous Plishti giant warrior named Yishbi, Asher, and this fellow Yishbi was a descendant of Harpa. Which is also interesting that we talk about the mother. We were talking about Yoav, who was always Ben Shruya, Goliath, and this is Goliath's brother. Apparently also they credit the mother. She had these giant kids. Other people say the reason they mention the mother is that Harpa is the same as Arpa. And Orpa was the co-wife of Rus. And Rus, Orpa at the last minute turned away from it all. In other words, she had the opportunity to become the head of the Jewish people, the royal mother, the same way Rus did, and she turned away from it all. And sometimes, like she had the potential to be very holy, and she went in the opposite direction. So sometimes we, you know, there are certain people that are not so holy, but they didn't have the possibility of being holy. They've never known anything different. Whereas Orpah was married to a Jewish person, had Rus, who was a very special lady as a sister-in-law, had the opportunity to become a mother of Israel and to be a great person. And in the end, she decided she would go back to the Plishtim. And she did. And her descendants fought against David. And I'll mention a Gemara what the Gemara says, which is just interesting. Now, her descendants were very known for being very strong, very big. So the descendant of Mishko Kino Sholosh Meos, his spear was 300 shekels, very heavy. You know, you got to be very strong to carry a heavy equipment. Mishko Nechovu Chaga Kadosh, and he had brand new armor, and he figured this was the opportunity to defeat David. So, again, we've got a battle that David goes into personally. We find David becoming weak, and we find that there's one of the Plishti giants, who's the descendant of Orpah, has the possibility of getting him. V'yazelo Avishai ben Shruya, and Yoav's brother Avishai comes to the rescue, v'yaketh Plishti, and he defeats the Plishti, v'imseyu, and he kills him. Oz nishma anshei David, and then the men of David swear, lomar, lo teitzi erei tanu lochama. Don't go with us in the war anymore. V'lo tekabe es ner Yisrael. Don't cut it. Now we have the name Ner Yisrael, right? The light of Israel. Don't, if you go to war and you were to be killed, the light of Israel would be destroyed. Don't go to war. Don't take any more chances.
But if this happened much earlier, that means that for many years David didn't go to war?
We don't know how many battles there were afterwards, perhaps that. Or it could be that this was actual fighting, but maybe to go in the battle, but not to do the fighting. It's not clear. So just wanted to read to you this interesting Gemara about this. It says that in the Book of Rus, it said that Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and Rus didn't kiss her, she just hugged her. So, Omer Rav Yitzchak, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rav Yitzchak said that God decided, Yabu B'nei HaNeshuka, let the one who was, she made a very external, you know, the kiss was like a very public showing. Some people are very external, meaning on the outside, they're very loving, but it's all a show. They want to do the outside show. And Rus, on the other hand, it emphasizes that she clung to her mother-in-law. She wasn't into making the very showy. It's not what they say, it's what they do. And so Rus clung. And so the left the descendants of the one that was external and into showiness but didn't have the inside, the descendants of the one, the kisser, let them fall in the hands of the one that clung, that B'nai Hadvuka, the one that clung to her. And, it says that even though she did turn away, Rava mentions that in reward for the tears that she cried when she left her mother, it says she cried four tears, so she had four descendants who were giants, who were very great warriors. And there's a whole discussion exactly what happened. Why was David weak? Why did God allow him to become weak? In other words, if Hashem was always with David, we had that before, that David was successful in all of his battles. So what did he do that made him weak? So David felt some guilt. It mentions over here where it says Yishbi, it says he was from Nov. And in fact, what's very interesting is, if you look in the English, at least in mine, they don't, they throw the word Nov later. I don't know why it says it later, but was one of the sons of Rapa was in Nov. The Hebrew, it says it right away, V'yishbi b'Nov, and verse 16. Why did it mention that he was from Nov? Nov was the city of Kohanim that Shaul had wiped out. David bared some guilt for that, because if you remember, he had stopped by there, and Shaul was very paranoid, and David knew his father-in-law. And the place where he stopped was where the Kohanim were, the other source of power in the country. And so by David going to where the Kohanim were, that planted his paranoid father-in-law thought that the Kohanim were in cahoots with David. And then David took his spear, which definitely led them to believe that they were helping him rebel against them. And so Shaul did a terrible sin, and he wiped out Nov. But David was guilty also because he was a little careless somehow, and allowing that to happen, he caused Nov to be wiped out. In other words, he also carried some of the sin. Now, that's why at this time, this giant, who also was from that area, David had a weak spot. His weak spot was that his carelessness had caused someone else to be hurt. And so therefore, he couldn't do it alone. He needed the help of Avishai, who came to the rescue at this time to save David. Okay, 18. But he after came to Yod Milchama Begov. Him pleased him, and they had other wars. And Oz he kissed Sabki Achushi Yesof Asherwidahopa, and the third of the big giants died. Again, each one of these giants led one of the. It's just interesting, just like you have the family of Yoav and Avishai, and we had a Saul who was killed earlier. You had this other family of the descendants of Orpah who were also great, mighty people. 19. Vationa Milchama, and there was another war. But Go Bima pleased him in with the Philistines. V'yakal Kanan Ben Yari, and we don't know much about this person. You run into this name today, Elchanan. That's a somewhat popular name. But Elchanan, the son of Yari, Orgin Beis Halachmi, and he was also one of the mighty warriors of Yehuda from the Bethlehem. He defeated as Goliath Hagiti. This is someone called another Goliath, Goliath the Giti. How do you know he was a great, strong person? Beitz Chaniso Kamino Orgim. And his spear was like the, they had these big looms that were like planted, you know, a big, huge loom. But usually a spear was a very thin thing because you had to carry it with you and you had to be able to move it back and forth. He had a very heavy spear. 20. There was another war. There are places which go into more depth of these battles, but our book doesn't give us the war stories. So we, you know, this particular study, we're not going to go into it that much. This particular giant, Esbos Yadav Esbos Raglov, he had six fingers and six toes. In other words, he was unusual. Was like a. It's just interesting how, you know, he was an unusually mighty person. His measurements were different than others. He had more fingers and more toes. When he made a fist, he had a fist of six fingers instead of a five-fingered fist. Eshim Barba Misbar, Begamhu, and he was the fourth of the giants that were descended from Horpa. 21. Becharef Es Yisrael, and he cursed the Jewish people. Yakeo Yonason, and we have another hero, Yonason ben Shimi Achi David. Now, by our heroes, we don't mention that they were super strong, that they had a spear the size of a beam, that they had six fingers and six toes. It's interesting. In other words, for them, it was all about their size and their might and their. With us, it's not certain people merit to, Hashem gives them the power to defeat their enemies, but we're not going to brag about, well, he has this kind of muscles or those kind of muscles. It's not our thing. You found that later, even with the Hashmonoim, you know, the great, some people like to make Yehuda HaMaccabee into the greatest fighter of all times. People that were very determined to fight to save lives, Hashem helped them go against many odds, but we're not going to brag about how big they were, how strong they were, how many toes they had, how many, I don't know, I'm trying to remember why it goes into the six fingers and the six toes. I think it just in general, he was just much larger than all those around him. I've seen people with an extra, I think they cut it out today if somebody has an extra toe or an extra, because it could, I guess they'll never be able to get a pair of shoes. But I don't know if the, 22. As Arba Ela Yod, and these four were born to Harpa, Begas, Vipu, Beyad, David, Beyad, Avadav, and they fell in the hands of David and in the hands of his servants. So these were the many battles. The important thing is, and that's what we're going to have in the next chapter, the next chapter is taken straight from Tehillim. And even though the book of Shmuel is not really Tehillim, but the praise of Hashem was so much part of David, the songs that he sang, Medrash said that he had a harp and he'd wake up in the middle of the night, and before the morning prayer he'd sit there and sing the praises of Hashem. He was an emotional person. He could inspire people to be grateful to Hashem. What a wonderful combination, you know, to be a warrior and to be a judge and to be able to inspire people, you know, at the same. So it's even though this isn't the book of Tehillim, it wants us to know that David, this mighty warrior, he would then use the occasion of the defeat in battle to thank Hashem for the defeat in battle, and that's what happened. V'daber David l'Hashem es divei hashir hazos, and David sang these words to Hashem, v'yam hitzo oso mikaf ko oivav, and the day that Hashem helped him defeat all of his enemies, and mikaf shol. Some people say that he never considered shol an enemy. He was an opponent, but not an enemy. Sometimes you have that, where someone is going against you, and you disagree with them, and they're wrong, but you don't hate them. They mean well, and you mean well. It's just, you know, sometimes you're on the wrong side. You know, they're on the other side. And so David had to defeat Shaul, because Shaul was in the way, but David appreciated who Shaul was. And so that's why it says all of his enemies and all and Shaul. Okay, we'll stop here. Chapter 22.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.